From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines, followed by a tribute to the late ufologist Stanton Friedman. Here's what's happening. The House of Representatives just passed a $3 trillion coronavirus relief bill, the most expensive legislation approved by that body in history, that Democrats hailed as the unprecedented response needed to deal with the pandemic and its economic fallout. The record-breaking bill narrowly passed by a 208-199 vote. 14 Democrats defied their party and voted no, while one Republican, Representative Pete King in New York, broke with the GOP and voted yes. It's huge legislation. Now, the bill extends add-on unemployment benefits of $600 in addition to state benefits through January of 2021, creates a special enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act exchanges for the uninsured, and provides $175 billion for families to pay their mortgages and rent. The legislation includes student loan forgiveness and employee retention tax credit, and increases maximum SNAP benefits by 15%. It's going to have a tough time getting through the Senate, so we'll follow that story. Now, as the states begin to lift restrictions for non-essential businesses, like restaurants and bars, are grappling with how to reopen while keeping both employee and customers safe. On Thursday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released guidelines instructing certain organizations on how to safely open up their doors. Layoffs in the United States jumped to a record high in March, of course, while the number of people voluntarily quitting their jobs dropped to a four-and-a-half-year low as the coronavirus crisis rapidly changed labor market dynamics as well. U.S. retail sales tumbling by a record 16.4% from March to April as business shutdowns caused by the coronavirus kept shoppers away, threatened the viability of stores across the country, and further weighed down a sinking economy. Meanwhile, JCPenney has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The company will intend to close many of its 800 stores. They're going through a final restructuring. Dr. Jerome Corsi has been following the pandemic for us, and here he is with his report. Jerry, what do you have for us?
Well, George, I think the pandemic has largely peaked, and the country is starting to get back to work, and I'm very hopeful we will get back to work. I'm not sure it's entirely over, but I think the worst of this particular wave is over, and I think the shutdown now has really reached the point of being economically disastrous, and we need to get back to work.
Do you think this stimulus bill is going to get through the Senate? I don't.
No, I don't think it has a chance, George. I think this is dead on arrival. There's too many Democratic social welfare kind of perks in this. And while we've spent trillions of dollars, and I think probably necessary to spend,
sure,
I don't think we need to go overboard with an agenda that's really not on target.
And you're still doing telemed through Corsi Nation?
Yes, we're doing that, and it's doing quite well. We're providing telemed consultations in CorsiNation.com, and the availability of a full range of medications to deal with COVID-19 as well as other illnesses and ailments. Meds delivered to your home if you want. You never have to leave your house.
All right, Jerry, we'll check in with you next week. Thanks for the report. A magnitude 6.5 earthquake struck in the remote western Nevada early Friday, according to the U.S. Geological Service, shaking people from Utah to California, and some pointing out that it happened near Area 51. But I don't think anything was going on there. On Saturday, the U.S. Air Force is expected to launch its secret space plane, the X-37B, for a long-duration mission on low Earth orbit. The robotic orbiter looks like a smaller version of the space shuttle and has spent nearly 8 of its past 10 years in space conducting classified experiments for the military. Almost nothing is known about what the X-37B does up there, but ahead of its 6th launch, the Air Force gave some rare details about its cargo. In addition to its usual suite of secret military technology, it will host a few unclassified experiments during its coming up sojourn in space. Let's check in now with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you have for us this week?
Good evening, George. This is sort of an exciting report. There's some wonderful reports that I'd like to share with the Coast audience tonight. First one comes from Conway, Arkansas. This past Sunday, a gentleman who described himself as working with high-tech equipment, doesn't go into details, writes that on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, he was sitting outside and he saw a very peculiar-looking orange triangular-shaped craft. Doesn't provide a great deal of detail. He said it made no noise. It was totally silent, went directly over his house and over his fields. Well, I include it because of the next report that comes from Granby, Colorado, gentleman who describes himself as a resort ski resort employee. George writes that at about 12:05 p.m. on the 12th, Tuesday of this past week, he was sitting at a drive-in restaurant when they became aware of three triangular-shaped craft in very tight formation. He said his first impression was it was three B-2 bombers in formation. The incredible thing is, though, he asserts that they did a loop over the town of Granby below the clouds. Couldn't possibly be a B-2 bomber. Very, very intriguing report. And he adds that they were totally silent. No sound from them whatsoever. Third report comes from the Maldives Islands, just off the southwest tip of the southern tip of India. A father and husband writes that they were sitting, four of them, his wife, his son, and his brother were sitting on a porch outside their apartment when they suddenly became aware of an object very, very bright streaking across the night sky. The incredible thing about this report, though, about the sighting, is that the object was changing not only its illumination but its color and changing its direction all at the same time.
Wow.
Very interesting incident there. Fourth report comes from Las Vegas. A young woman who describes herself as a medical professional states that she was out actually smoking, and she saw a bright orange orb, a sphere, streaking across the sky. It, too, like in the previous report, was changing its illumination and color. It suddenly turned to the north and shot across the mountains. Fifth and final report I'd like to share comes from Tempe, Arizona. Gentleman writes that he saw a very bright, very colorful object come down out of the sky from near the moon. This is yesterday morning at 1:59 a.m., Tempe, Arizona. Gentleman saw an object come down out of the sky, streak around the sky, and disappear from sight, headed north. So there's a lot going on, George. That's how the world looks from my vantage
point. Yeah, these reports are everywhere. Thank you. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, the man who brought us the story of the black-eyed children now brings us Monsters of the Last Frontier, Cryptids and Legends of Alaska. David Weatherly with us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back on a Friday night. George Norrie with you, our special guest for the next couple hours, David Weatherly. David, of course, is a person of the strange and supernatural. He has traveled the world in search of mysterious monsters, ghosts, magic, folklore, and legends, and from dusty castles to strange remote islands to ancient sites. He has journeyed to the most unusual places on the planet, seeking the unknown. David has become fascinated with the weird and unusual at an early age, and for decades he has charted a course of exploration and investigation of the unexplained. Several of his books include Strange Intruders, The Black-Eyed Children. We'll get an update from him on that in a moment. And the new one, Monsters of the Last Frontier, Cryptids and Legends of Alaska. David, my friend, welcome back to the program.
Good evening, George. Always good to talk with you.
And are you hunkered down when everything's safe and sound for you and your family?
Oh, all's good.
Super, super. Give me an update on black-eyed children. Anything going on? We still getting those stories?
I had a funny feeling you were going to ask that. Well, you know, I still get reports on a regular basis, George, and for the most part, you know, they still fall within the same spectrum of previous incidents. You know, people reporting these kids showing up and asking strange things and so forth. However, as you and I have discussed before, the thing that intrigues me the most about this phenomenon are the really old reports that keep surfacing. And as you know from my work, I've continued on doing a lot of other things, but I still get the reports. And there are a lot of people out there who are digging into various archives and coming across these accounts that really fit the parameters of these black-eyed children encounters. Those are the ones I find very fascinating because it gives more weight to the history of the phenomena, if you will. So one of the accounts, or the account I wanted to talk to you about tonight, is one that surfaced from a Bigfoot book. Now, this is a book published in 1976. Several sharp readers passed this along to me in the past year. And I went back and read the account myself. It's from a book by Alan Berry and Ann Slate. As mm-hmm. I said, came out in 1976. Deals with Sasquatch encounters mainly in California in the years preceding their publication. And they talk about a story in there that I found kind of mind-boggling. The gentleman in question, the witness, was a man named Andrew Stone, who was living in Antelope Valley. Now, this is going back pretty far. He had a series of encounters related to Bigfoot. But there's one particular encounter that he talks about, and Slate and Barry cover in their book, that is something more than just a Sasquatch. Stone fell asleep one night watching television,
mm-hmm.
and he wakes up to his wife shaking him. She's holding her finger at her lips, in other words, to be quiet. The reason being, George, the front door of their home is shaking and jiggling. Someone's trying to get in that door. Now, yeah. It's 3:30 in the morning.
That's not a good feeling, that's for sure.
It's not a good feeling. Stone grabs a shotgun, jumps over to the door. He opens that door about halfway, lets it swing open. Positive he's going to catch the culprit standing there on his porch, right?
Yeah.
Nothing there.
Jeez.
Not on the porch. However, in the dirt down off beyond the porch are a pair of teenagers who look at Stone and say in unison, "We don't want to be hurt."
Oh, boy.
Now, I'm going to break for a second and say, you know, you listen to the parameters of this encounter, there's a weird language. And what a strange thing to say. Because Stone is hiding that shotgun behind the door. They couldn't possibly see that he's armed. All they see is a man swing the door open.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as he's standing there looking at these two young men, they start to tell him why they're there. They say, "Oh, we ran out of gas 7 miles down the road, and we saw this phone booth at the bottom of the road down here, and we saw the porch light on at your house. So we came up to borrow a dime so we can call to bring us gas. We'll return the money." Now, Stone, George, he's former law enforcement. So he's thinking, okay, this story doesn't add up.
No, not at all.
What's the former lawman doing? He's observing these guys. Now, he notices that the boys' clothes are spotless. And Stone's quote is, "They're spanking new out of a store." Not only that,
almost, you know, like right off the rack.
Right off the rack. Now, you know, they're out in they've come up a canyon road, a dirt road, that prior to that, purportedly, they've walked 6 miles. Former lawman, he's looking at their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
He says the shoes were shiny black patent leather with round toes.
No dust, no dirt, nothing.
Not a speck of dust, George, nothing. So he's standing there thinking, you know, this really doesn't add up. What's going on? How, you know, how did these kids supposedly walk 7 miles or more, not get dirty? He says, okay, hold on here a moment. He closes the door. He goes in and gets him a dime. Now, his wife's inside, sitting down, holding their dog, who normally was a great watchdog, but is now shivering in fear.
Wow.
Not making a whimper. Stone goes back out. He says that he walks right up to the boys because he wanted to place the dime in the boy's palm so that it didn't fall in the dirt. But he says when he went to place it in the boy's hand, it's as if there was nothing there. He said he felt like he didn't even place it on anything. Now, Stone goes back in the house. He takes a seat, and as soon as he does, he suddenly remembers that the phone booth down the hill doesn't have a light on it. And he's thinking, you know, it's dark. These kids are going to get lost. So he grabs a flashlight. He's going to go and hand it to these kids. He walks back outside. They're gone. They have vanished.
Jeez.
He scans the area. He says that he could see in every direction clearly. The walk down the hill to the phone booth was a couple hundred yards. He could see it easily. No matter which direction they had taken, he would have seen them, but there's nothing there. He's looking all over. He goes all the way down to the road. He searches everywhere. There's not a sign of these two boys. But even creepier, he said that when he was outside, he suddenly realized when he was searching for these boys that the night was dead silent. No noise, no crickets, no fog.
Nothing. Highly unusual.
Nothing. Complete silence. And here's the kicker, George. Now, Stone says that he, again, that law enforcement thing goes over and over the details of the encounter, right? He's thinking about these kids. Every detail he can remember. You know, these guys are trained observers. So there's one thing that has always disturbed him about the encounter. He cannot remember seeing their eyes.
Wow. Of course, it was dark and everything else, but still.
But he was very close to them. His porch was lit, you know, and he remembered so many of the other details. He remembered the hair color, you know, the details of the clothing, because he's observing all of these things, but nothing. In his memory about their eyes, and that really unsettled this man.
Do they try to get in the house, David? I mean, there's, you know, the door was rattling and stuff. What do they want?
Well, that's kind of the question on everyone's mind, isn't it? You know, these encounters, one after another, these children, I don't think they're children at all, obviously, but, you know, they're trying to gain entry. But it's weird, George, because it's like the old vampire mythology. You know, they don't seem to be able to enter unless they're invited.
Right.
So, again, they try to elicit this invitation. Now, this story's a little bit different, of course, but it's so many of those parameters, and we have to remember this is a much older account, you know, before there was any such acronym as BEK or Black Eyed Children or anything like that. But it certainly fits all those parameters, you know, the disturbed feeling that the witness had and how shaken he was, the eeriness of the entire encounter, all these elements, you know, the weird language, you know, we don't want to be hurt. Who says that? You know, and if they really came up there to borrow money for a phone, you know, why rattle the door? How did they get from the door to down in the dirt? You know, there's just all of these weird, anomalous things. This is typical of these Black-Eyed Children encounters.
And I'm wondering if the door was open when they rattled it, if they would have walked in.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? You know, if we base it on so many of the other accounts, I mean, I've never heard of an encounter where these kids enter without an invitation, where they barge in or force their way in or anything like that.
Once they're in, how do you get rid of them? Think about that. David, we're going to come back. We'll talk briefly about the Black Eyed Kids, then we'll get into your latest work, Monsters of the Last Frontier. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with David Weatherly. David's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, erielights.com. David, a few more quick questions about the Black Eyed Children, then we'll get into Monsters of the Last Frontier. If you do let them in, what has happened to people? Do we have any reports on that?
You know, there's very few reports, George. The tricky thing with this, of course, is that, you know, there are a lot of stories that get posted online, and it's always hard to track many of those people down and get an interview or get further details. There are some claims that, you know, these kids are invited in and dire things happen to family members and so forth. I've had a few accounts that were chronicled in the book from people that I was able to interview who had what I would call very close encounters with the kids. You know, maybe they reached out and touched them or something like that. And usually the consequences are pretty bad. But, you know, what always kind of lingers in the back of my mind is Whitley Strieber said something to me years ago about this phenomenon. He said, you know, the thing that disturbs me is how many people have let them in that we don't know about.
Yeah.
And that's
a good point.
Kind of an unsettling way to think about it, you know, because if these things really are as dangerous as they seem, then, yeah, maybe there are a lot of counts that we just don't hear about.
What does your investigative gut tell you about this? I mean, are they beings that are trying to trick us, looking like children? What do you think's going on? Yeah,
absolutely. I don't believe for a moment that they're children. I think that they're... I think they're entities from another level of existence, if you will.
A dark dimension.
Another dimension, yeah. And, you know, even a few years ago, that would have sounded far-fetched. But with what quantum physics is learning now, you know, the quantum sciences are exploring all these concepts of other levels of existence. And, you know, there you go. If there's something there that can get over here, maybe they're coming over to test the waters or to who knows what they're doing. A lot of the cases lead me to believe that they're coming over here because they feed off of emotion. They feed off of fear because so many of the cases, George, they produce this intense level of fear in the witness or the victim, if you will. And when that peak is kind of reached, these kids disappear. So it's sort of, okay, mission accomplished.
Absolutely. Monsters of the Last Frontier. How did you key in on Alaska?
You know, actually, George, this is part of a series. This is the third state that I've covered. I realized at some point how extensive my files were from investigating and doing field work for so many years. And I had spent some time in Alaska. It's a very intriguing place. It came up next on my list to do. To focus just on the cryptids in that state. And that's what I did. I don't know if you've been to Alaska, but it's a very intriguing place.
Never been up that way.
There's something sort of otherworldly about it in a sense. And while I can't imagine living there because of the cold that dominates so much of the year, at the same time, it has a very unique raw beauty. And, you know, the people are just wonderful. So when I started delving into the cryptid legends up there, oh, my gosh, you talk about a rich body of folklore and tons of modern sightings, too.
And, David, the cryptids and legends of Alaska, I mean, they're all over the place, aren't they?
They are. They're all over the whole state. And, you know, you have to remember something, George. This is Alaska is the least densely populated state.
So, right. It's the biggest, but it's the least densely populated.
The largest state. And I always tell people, unless you've been to Alaska, it's hard to really conceive of how big it is. You know, some people look on a map and say, okay, Alaska's way up there. You take the outline of Alaska and lay it over the lower 48, and then you suddenly start to realize we're talking about a lot of territory. It's over 660,000 square miles.
Wow. And you could walk to Russia. just about.
Yeah, it could walk through us. And it's very rugged territory, you know, so much of it uninhabited. Of course, the people that live there for the most part cluster around the major cities and in small villages.
Now, when we talk about cryptids and legends of Alaska in the book Monsters of the Last Frontier, give us an overview, first of all, of what kinds of subjects we're talking about.
Oh, gosh. So a lot of Sasquatch sightings. You know, there's so much wild territory up there. And these accounts go far, far back in the state's history because the native tribes in the region, they've talked about these creatures all the way back in their oral traditions. And, you know, Alaska has 227 recognized tribes. So, again, that's a lot of different bodies of people. They all have their own terms to describe these hairy creatures that live in the wild. We've got water monsters up there, of course, because a lot of water in Alaska. You know, it's obviously on the ocean, but freshwater lakes and water in abundance. So a lot of various water creature sightings. Some other strange tales, too, back in the lore. Some of them connect to native traditions. You know, there's rumors of a 10-footed bear that seemed to come out of old native lore in the region. But there's other curious stories. There's legends of living mammoths having wandered Alaska far beyond the time that they purportedly perished. There are Thunderbird sightings. And then there are a few other curious stories that crop up here and there, like the Harry Culp story, Harry D. Culp, and there's Lake Iliamna's monster, and there's a really weird tale about a town called Portlock or Port Chatham.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is that Port Chatham story? Why don't you tell us?
Oh, gosh. So the story with that town was that it was a small little cannery town, and it became a real place on the map, if you will, in the 1920s when a post office opened in the town. But it really never grew to any significant size. The census in 1940 only listed just over 30 residents in the town, and almost all of them were employed at the cannery. So what happens with this town is that it sort of disappears very suddenly because everyone up and moves out.
Jeez.
And
they get spooked or what?
Well,
here we go.
The story kind of unfolds over time, and this has been covered pretty well by the press in Alaska. The first mention of significance was in 1973 when the Anchorage Daily News started talking about the strangeness of the town, and it said that Portlock just ceased to exist because everyone left. They were afraid of the hairy man that was terrorizing the town. Now, the chronicle of this town goes back to purportedly the first death was in 1931. There was a logger who was working just in the hills outside of the town, and he was found murdered. However, here's the kicker, George. The murder weapon was a piece of log-moving equipment that no human could have lifted. Yet somehow this man was bashed in the head with it.
Jeez.
So that was the first mysterious thing. But then other strange deaths. You know, and some of this, it's very difficult to sort out, of course, all of the exaggerated lore and the real incidents, because there are stories of hunters finding 18-inch footprints in the snow around the village. There are stories of hunters going up into the hills and never returning, but this is kind of gruesome, pieces of their body washing down.
Oh my God.
In the water, and the markings, the villagers said, were nothing like a bear would have done. So what really becomes fascinating about the story is that in 2009, the Homer Tribune, a reporter with the paper, ran a story, interviewed a elder who had been born in Port Chatham in the 1930s. And this woman told the stories and said that she remembered her family being terrified and that they all fled, that they left their schools and they left their school and they left their homes because of the Nanchinook. And that was the regional name for roughly translates as Big Hairy Man. And it was this, she described this frightening figure that was a man beast that was killing people. And finally, the villagers said, you know, enough, we've lost enough people. En masse, they just all up and left, and they just dropped everything and left them. So the place remains very mysterious. It's very difficult to access. You know, you can look on travel information for the region, and a lot of times they'll say you can get there by ATV or something, but it really, you can't. You pretty much need to go in by bush plane or by boat. And I tried a couple of different times to get there, but weather conditions wouldn't allow on some of my trips. I've spoken to a number of people that have been to the site, and they said that even today, that it's a very eerie experience to walk through this little village. And one person told me, he said, you know, I've been there and I was so unnerved. I felt like something was watching us the entire time.
You mentioned the story of Harry Culp. Who is he? Who was he?
Oh, boy, that's a good one, George. So in 1900, this gentleman named Harry D. Culp was a prospector in Alaska, looking for his fortune, looking to strike it rich. And Culp, this entire tale comes from his own handwritten manuscripts. He wrote the details of his experiences out. And they were lost for a long time. His daughter found them in the 1950s. And she actually published the manuscript. It's a little booklet. You can still get it sometimes. And it was titled The Strangest Story Ever Told. And when you read this thing, you think, wow, it kind of is, at least for Alaska. So getting back to it, Harry D. Culp was a prospector. He joined up with three other guys, and they had a plan to look for a place to dig for their fortunes. Mm-hmm. And they'd heard these stories about there being gold in Thomas Bay. Now, they kind of grouped together in Wrangell and elected one of their group to go out and do some initial prospecting to see if it was worth the trip. They send this guy out, Culp tells him Charlie. They send Charlie out. They don't expect to see him, George, for about 3 months. But he comes back in a very short period. He walks in their cabin. He tosses down this huge chunk of cord. It's flecked with gold all over. These guys are naturally very, very excited. Charlie says, I'll tell you tomorrow. He goes to sleep. These poor guys have to wait, you know, all night and the next day. So the next afternoon, Charlie finally sits down and he says, I'll tell you the whole story, but I need you guys to do something. I need you to give me the money to catch this steamer ship that's coming through. I'm going to Seattle. I never want to hear about this place again.
Wow. He was out.
He was out. He says, I'm out. I'm never coming back to Alaska. Now, they agree, and he begins to tell them the story. He tells them about this story about his encounter in Thomas Bay. He goes, he's looking around. He's taking a canoe. He's gone way out in the wild. He finds what appears to be a really rich vein of gold. He gets this chunk of quartz out. And as he's climbing around, he drops his rifle and basically breaks it. You know, it's fairly useless, but he's carrying it anyway. He's trekking across, getting his bearings and making, you know, notes of landmarks, and he wants to check some other areas to see how wide this vein may go. But then, George, he has this very disturbing experience, and he says it was the scare of his life, and that he prays to God that he never has to go through anything like it again. And I'm actually going to read you the quote, but so that it's done justice. This is what Charlie says. He says, swarming up the ridge toward me from the lake were the most hideous creatures. I couldn't call them anything but devils,
wow,
as they were neither men nor monkeys, yet looked like both. They were entirely sexless, their bodies covered with long, coarse hair, except where the scabs and running sores had replaced it. Each one seemed to be reaching out for me and striving to be the first to get to me. The air was full of their cries, and the stench from their sores made me faint. Now,
jeez,
you can imagine being in this man's position in the 1900s, early 1900s. He's in the middle of nowhere, and he sees this dreadful sight, you know, coming at him. He tries to raise his gun up to fire at them, but then he realizes the gun's busted. It won't fire. So he just starts running, and he makes it somehow to his canoe. He jumps into the canoe, and he said that as he's running from them, he can feel what feels like the claws on their fingers scraping at his back.
Hold on for a second, David. We'll pick up the Harry Culp story when we come back. Plus, we'll talk about the largest lake in Alaska where people think there's a monster there. And, of course, we'll take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.